I prepared a little bit of an introduction to the subject, which I'll try to keep the introduction to a minimum, but I think it's important to get a sense of this thing that I would like to study with you. It's an unusual sefer. There's an introduction to it that I'd like to begin with. That begins. This is a one of a kind type of sefer. It's very unusual, and it was written in the 18th century, but it was embraced by the Musar movement, which came onto the scene in the middle part of the 19th century. So, just a word about the Musar movement and movements in general among Jews. Jews love movements. So, like I said, we've had lots of movements over our history. Some of them, you know, just didn't matter. Some of them became part of the mainstream of our Masorah, of our tradition, and some ended up doing terrible damage, like the movement of Shapsi Tzvi was damaging, the movement of the Tzedukim, of the Pharisees, the Sadducees. I don't know which are the bad guys. I don't know. It was very damaging. The Karoyim, if you know what these things are, very damaging. Within the context of tradition, there have also been movements. Within the last few hundred years, we had the Hasidim, and then we had the Baalei Musar. This is an Ashkenazic part of the world. I really am not familiar much with what was going on in the Sephardi part of the world, but among Ashkenazic Jewry, we had these things. And what Musar was about, as I understand it, was that it addressed what its founders saw as a need of that time, and its founders felt that people were losing sight of the relationship between being the God-fearing Jew and being a person of exemplary character. And in reality, the foundation of serving God in the most elementary way is just built on the recognition that God does so much for us, keeps us going. The Talmud says that before someone takes a breath, God decrees that he should take a breath. It's not that we just go on autopilot. God is constantly sustaining us, constantly decreeing that we should be here, and keeps everything going, keeps the sun shining, so to not acknowledge in a very serious way the receipt of so much generosity is very very bad for somebody. If somebody gets so much from somebody and they just ignore it, that would cause a stain in your character, to not pay, we say basic decency, Menschlichkeit, as we say in Yiddish. So, at the heart of being a religious Jew is the basic trait of gratitude. So, if a person has a spouse or a parent from whom they receive a great deal on a constant basis, and they're not grateful, then how can you then go ahead and turn around and say to God, I want this and I want that and I want that, and think that you're a terrific guy? So the people began to lose the connection, and the Baalei Musar came to strengthen that part of our avoda, of our service of God. like most movements that start, they were attacked. Because the problem with movements is that they sometimes start running on their own and they become almost a separate Judaism. And it happens, usually, that even within legitimate movements, there's sometimes like a lunatic fringe, that even when the main part of the movement is accepted, but the lunatic fringe is not. And Musser also had a semi-lunatic fringe. But the mainstream yeshivas of Musser, Mir, Slobodka, were not lunatic. They became pretty much integrated into the yeshiva world of Eastern Europe, Lithuanian yeshiva world in any case. This book, Cheshbon HaNefesh, was one of their favorites, or was a popular book. Rav Yisrael Salanter, who started the Muslim movement, advised that it be printed. Now, on the Feldheim, in the back of the Feldheim book, I think he says that it was first printed in 1812, and Rav Yisrael Salanter advised it to be reprinted in 1845. I think on the title page of the book, it says that it was first printed in 1845. So I don't know when it was first printed, but it's not a modern book. You know, it's not a contemporary book by any sense of the word. What it comes to do is it comes to tell people and to explain to people how they can actually change a personality. Now, those of us that have been around for, you know, a couple of years, you have the experience of knowing somebody, let's say, for the last 5 years. And you'll notice that, generally speaking, they don't change. Your kids change, you know, their little kids, their lives change, adolescents change because their lives change, young adults change because their lives change. It's not really that it's a self-initiated change, it's just that their lives are in flux, so sometimes the flux results in a difference in personality. You know, you're married this type of person, so you're changed. You ended up in this kind of a job with this kind of a boss, you're changed. But once you hit your strides and the changes don't come so quickly, then you're the same. And I could tell you that, having known a lot of people for more than 5 years, you know, they don't change over 40 years also. You know, the same basic person that you knew 40 years ago is that way now. And it's very, very hard. It's very hard. It's almost impossible to really change a personality. And what this Sefer is about is how to go about this process. It begins, the first part of it begins with a fascinating exploration of how people tick. Like, what makes a person tick? What causes what? What causes this? What causes that? And I just hope that we can somehow get into it together. If this serves as something of an inspiration, I'll take more time off from studying the actual book to just relate this bit of Musar wisdom to you. You know, we have this famous question. There's a famous question. It says that Moshe was the most modest of people. V'ish Moshe anuv mo'od. Moshe was very modest. Kol adam asher al pnei ha'adam, something like that. The Pasuk says more than modest than anyone that ever walked the face of the earth. But we also say, you know, when we sing Yigdal on Friday night after shul, if you sing Yigdal, or if you say it in the morning, that Lo kam b'Yisrael kamosho, there was never a person like Moshe. So the classical question that's asked is, if Moshe was the greatest, so how could he also be the most modest? Because unless he was very, very unaware of things, he knew that he was the greatest. He knew that he had attained the closeness to God that the forefathers didn't attain. So he therefore was indeed greater than even the forefathers. So then how could he be so modest? And this question I know maybe other answers to it. Rav Yisrael Salanter says that there's a book of things that he said or that he wrote, I'm not sure, called Evan Yisrael. In Evan Yisrael, this question is posed, and the answer that he gives is as follows. He says that it's true Moshe was the greatest person, and it's true that he knew it, and it's true that he was the most modest. But, he said, you have to look at what exactly is that constitutes greatness. So, providing my own, just way of explaining it with the contemporary examples. Let's say if, God wants us to study Torah. We have two people. One was born with a 90 IQ, and one was born with 150 IQ. They both study for an hour. The fellow with 150 IQ covers this and that. The other one can barely get through a sentence, and then they go on. So 5 years later, or 10 years later, with equal diligence, the one with 150 IQ is a famous Rav, and the other guy is just a bare, fair to middling kind of a fellow, and in 10 years he did what the other man did in a half year. So who's the bigger Talmud Chacham? Say, well, in a certain way, of course, the 150 IQ is a bigger Talmud Chacham. He's the famous Rav. You ask him a shiloh, he knows what the answer is. He's the guy that knows the stuff. But when God looks down from heaven and says, who's the greater Talmud Chacham? So, to God, to the Rabbi Shalom, here you have someone that was getting famous for his learning. Came easy to him, he didn't have to work that hard. Here you had someone that worked just to study the Torah of the Almighty, and he worked so hard, and he worked so diligently. He got no respect for it. He got no position from it, he got no livelihood from it, and he still plugged away. Probably, to the Almighty, the other one is more important. Because, look what God doesn't need the knowledge of 150 IQ. He can do without it. So to the Almighty, what really matters is how much you put out, how much you put in, what's your sincerity of the heart. What did you do based on what you were started with? So that means that when you're Moshe, so you read the Chumash like a good Cheder kid, and that when Moshe was born, the house was filled up with light. When I was born, I never heard that the hospital was filled up with light, like it was when Moshe was born. So if you're born that way, when that happens, you may indeed become Moshe, but towards as far as God, God might say that the individual input and sincerity, based on what I started with, might be greater than Moshe. Than me, Baruch Gans, or you, or any one of you, or anyone. So Moshe said, listen, I'm the greatest. I am indeed 150 IQ. I did. But, to God, he doesn't need, he's not impressed by my knowledge. He doesn't need my knowledge. To him, it's all the same. So that's how he explains it. The Rav Yisrael Salanter also said that it's worth working at Musar for a lifetime. And this is a typical classical Musar statement. He says it's worth working at Musar for a lifetime. So if one time when you speak Lashon Hara, you'll feel bad about it. One time you'll feel bad about it. So it's worth it. So my Rebbe explained that he said, listen, but that one time was my doing. See, there, in that one time, I changed what I would have otherwise been. And it's not that I'm going on autopilot. So really, all this leads us to the conclusion that things which are the result of your dedicated, your dedicated focus on changing yourself, are of great significance, in many respects more than so much of a lifetime of doing things on autopilot, which to a large measure we do, and that's why we stay the same year in, year out, year in, year out, year in, year out, because we don't have like this kind of like stand back, step away from myself, look at yourself, figure out what your spreadsheet is, and do something about it. And this book is about just that. The other works of Musar speak in generalities about what a person should be and what's virtuous and what's not virtuous. But the problem is that you can know that and then still act the same way, because it's very hard to create a meaningful linkage between that which you know to be correct and your actual ongoing conduct. And again, this is what this book sets out to do. The organizer of this little group explained to me that we have to end at 9 o'clock. I want to at least study something tonight of the actual book. But I want to point out there was an introduction written to it. One of the printings of the book took place in the Great it was sponsored by the students or some organization. I don't know exactly when. It was in the early 20th century. And included with that printing was an introduction by Rabbi Isaac Scher. Rabbi Isaac Scher was a son-in-law, I believe, of the Alter of Slobodka, of Nosson Zvi Finkel, who was the great Musar mentor of the Slobodka Yeshiva, whose students really did much to rebuild Torah in the United States after the Second World War. Many, if not most, of the great yeshivas were somehow connected up with Slobodka, including the one that I went to. So I would like to start with that. Okay? One final word of introduction. And I'll say this. We're going to be doing an English text. So it begs the question, if we have an English text, so what do you need me for? You have an English text. Just read the English. So I hope that, for the most part, you don't need my input, but I'll try to sort of embellish what he says in a way to make it more meaningful. I'll tell you one story about that very quickly. One of the things that the Alter Slobodka did in Europe is that he tried to support every yeshiva, even the yeshiva that was not involved with Musar or opposed Musar, because it was a yeshiva and they were studying Torah. He had a great, successful yeshiva. He did everything he could to support them. So the Rebbe of my Rebbe, Rabbi David Leibowitz, was one of his great students. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the father of Rav Yashaver Soloveitchik, was here in Boston, started a yeshiva in a place called Raisin, in Lithuania. I think it was in Lithuania, around that part of the world. And he sent a group of students to the yeshiva for a number of months. So one of the students that he sent was Rav David Leibowitz, my Rebbe's Rebbe. So he knew Rav Moshe Soloveitchik from that time. He was something of a student of his. Then he came to America in the late 20s. Rav David Leibowitz came to America. In the late 30s, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik came and moved to New York and became the Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva Yitzchak Ochanan. I don't know if the college was YU then. So he came and they made a reception in his honor when he came. So what does a Rosh Yeshiva do when they make a reception in his honor? And he gets up and says a shir. He wasn't going to get up and tell jokes. Were they going to give him a you know, give him a gold fountain pen. Like, he got up and he said a shir. So at the shir, he said over Torah that his father had said, the great Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. He said over his father's Torah. So Reb David came with a few of his Talmidim, and they sat there and they heard the shirs. And they came home. Reb David said to them, really, oh, such a great shir. So he said over this about Reb Chaim, that Reb Chaim. So Reb David said to the students, he says, what did you need him for? You know, the boy's got, you know, was like so irreverent, you know. What do you need him for? In other words, he said, if all he's doing is saying over what his father said, so what do you need him for? What did Rav Moshe contribute here? They said they were totally flummoxed. They didn't know what to say. So he said, I'll tell you what he needed him for. So he went through the shir, step by step. He said, this is what Reb Chaim said. You could have said this, you could have said this, you could have said that. This is how Rav Moshe explained it. He said, at every step, he was bringing Reb Chaim to life. He was explaining what he really meant. And that was his job. So I hope that'll be my job. You know, I'll try to do my best to embellish, hopefully within the context of what it actually says. Yeah, probably. Yeah, I would say so. All right. So I want to begin with the introduction of Rav Isaac Scher. I will try to read the Hebrew and translate it in my own words. It's on page 2. And you can please interrupt me, stop me, questions, whatever you want. And I'll try to explain it as best as I can, translating it into English, but not, you know, verbatim as the translator does. All right, here we go. B'sefer Nechbad Zu, in this honored book, Sefer, Misbarim Inyanim Chashuvim, Mechachmas HaMusar, are explained many important ideas, issues of the wisdom, of the insight of Musar, Shalom Utsonum B'Shar Sefer Musar Shabiyadeinu, that we didn't find in other books of Musar in our hands that we have. Val shnei korim chashuvim, and they're regarding two fundamentals, two significant fundamentals, which only lahoyer es hamayin, though I want to, wake up. It's hard to translate. What does he say? Draw the reader's attention to them, Bashir Yidiyosam Nechutzim Od, that their knowledge is very vital, Mischanchim Bavodas HaMusar, to those that will be guided through the work of Musar. Meaning that what he's going to do is he's going to embellish the book by giving you a preamble of some basic ideas that the book doesn't really articulate so clearly. Why doesn't he articulate it so clearly? That's a good question. But you have this very, very often in works of Torah. And the way I understand it is as follows. You sometimes live in a time where certain things are given. Say, if you were to hear a conversation or read papers that an academic within a certain subject wrote. Now, it may be that if somebody doesn't understand anything about the subject, there's some glaring holes in the logic and glaring holes in what they're saying, because there's certain stuff that's left out. But if someone is in the subject matter, that's a given. You know, that thing might be a given. That's why they didn't write about it. But that's understood. Like, we talk, we understand certain things. We talk about almost anything. There's certain things that are given. Someone that doesn't know about it, you know, he wouldn't be able to follow our conversation. So you have that sometimes with Torah, that in a certain time, certain things were given. You didn't have to explain it. Somebody looks at it 150 years later, what's going on? So he said, this is a given. So Rav Isaac Sher felt that these things, these two basic things that he wanted to tell us about, are necessary as a preamble to understanding what he said. So there's two ikarim. He said, ikar harishon, the first ikar, the first fundamental, who havonas. Now, here already it gets tricky. Hu havonas, it's the understanding, darche, the way, yitziras hamachshava, the origin of thought. So he says, how do you come to think a certain thing? Well, that's already a pretty fascinating, pretty fascinating question right there. I think a thought, I like Sarah Palin, and I don't like Hillary Clinton. But then someone else likes Hillary Clinton, she doesn't like Sarah Palin. Well, why did I think this way, and why do you think the other way? Or why do I think this about that, and that about this, and so on and so forth? He goes, well, that's me. Maybe. Maybe it's you. Maybe you were born, you're preordained to like Hillary or Sarah. But maybe not. Maybe something went on that caused you to think that way. Well, if that's the case, what went on? And how did it happen that you thought that way? So Rav Isaac Sher said that to understand the book, he said you have to have some supplemental knowledge on the subject of how thoughts germinate within your head. And that's what he's going to talk about now. This is the first of his two ikarim. So here's what he says. Borer lakol. It is clear to all. Shem ha'odon eino yodea umakir es atzmo. That if a person doesn't know himself, lo yoil lo limud ha-musar, it won't help to study musar. And he's talking now about general musar. General musar, again, as I said before, musar was not ever something that existed outside of the Torah. It was only a heightened focus on already existing aspects within the whole context of the Torah. The idea of being a nice guy and being grateful and being kind and being, being modest, that didn't start when Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was born, the father of the Musar movement. He took books that were always part of the Jewish Torah scholarship that spoke about these things, and he said that we should give a little direct extra attention to them. But these things are always there. Now that's what we generally refer to as Limud HaMusar. We study Musar books, it's referred to in the Shulchan Aruch, which came way before the Musar movement, that every day a person should spend a certain amount of time reading Musar books. There were Musar books around in those days, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Chovos HaLevavos is one, the Shari Tshuva, the Orech HaTzadikim. These books were here, a long time ago, and they were part of the Jewish tradition that we study them. So he says that these things don't help if you don't know yourself. Even she'eino yodea machoser lo, he doesn't know what's missing by him. Umash she'yesh lo lusaken, and what he has to repair. So if a person wants to, now this is only a mashal, this is not what he's about to launch into, but he says, just like when you study Musar, you have to first know yourself, so too, what we're about to say. But that mashal is itself significant, that people think, if you buy a self-help book and they tell you how to do this right and how to do that right, even if the self-help book is on the beam, it's not crazy, which is certainly not a foregone conclusion. But none of that helps until we first make a study of what we are. Because you may be, we can be very blind to our strengths and weaknesses. And when you get into a self-help book, you might try to help something that doesn't need that much help, and you're oblivious to something that needs a lot of help. So he says, it's known, it's bar yodua, bar lakol, it's known to everybody that to study mostly you first have to know yourself, otherwise it doesn't work. Then he says, kainhu, now here's where it starts to really dig in. It's the third line in this paragraph. He says, kainhu, gam, so too it is also, hayodea umakir midosov halotovim. A person knows which of his traits are not good. Yefshur lo lischanech bavodas hamusar. He cannot be helped, trained through the work of musar. I mean, even if he knows, like he's saying, now let's say somebody that knows already what's missing by him. First, he said it doesn't work if you don't know what you are. Well, let's say I know. I gave a good hard look at myself. I consulted with others. I know that these are my sore spots, my soft spots, my areas of deficiency. He said, even someone who knows this, yefshelo lischanech bavodas hamusar, he cannot be trained with avodas hamusar. Calls manshul yisbar etzlo, as long as it's not clarified to him, ba'er heitev, very well, with great, good explanation. Darche yitziras ha-machshava, the ways of the creation of thought. V'ofne hispatchuso, and the way of its origination. I believe that's the word, hispatchuso. What does English say? The modes of thought development. B'pnei sheha ha-hakara ha-chitzona ba-midos eino hakar shleimo. For the outward understanding of character traits is not a complete understanding. Meaning, let's say I got a real understanding of what my true strengths and true weaknesses are. Something which most people do not have. It's very, very hard to find someone that has a realistic assessment of what they are. But let's say someone had it. He said, you can't go about fixing yourself, even if you have that, unless you know how thoughts germinate. That's what he says. So now he says, Shahamidos heim, this is the third line from the end of the paragraph, Shahamidos heim rikshim penimium banefesh. The midos, character traits, are inner feelings within the soul, the inner feelings of the soul. Umiskalim b'machshava, and they are revealed through thought. Umishtarshim b'a, and they become rooted into a person's thoughts. Meaning, I guess, that let's say if a person has jealousy, or he's going to give the example of jealousy, let's pick something else. Let's say if a person has the trait of miserliness. That's a trait. Some people are more generous, some people are more miserly. So if a person has miserliness is only like an emotional stirring of the soul. But from an emotional stirring of the soul, you don't come to act in a miserly way, which is to not give charity. Something else happened. There's like a missing link. So what happens is that the stirring of the soul of miserliness expresses itself in a thought, and the thought is that I don't want to give charity to this appeal. Now, there's some way that this inner feeling of the soul gets translated into a thought, and then the thought results in a different decision, different activity. So someone that didn't have the miserliness saw the worthwhile nature of the appeal, and he gave money, or she gave money. And someone who had the miserliness, they came up with the thought, not that I'm miserly and that's why I don't want to give it, but I'm of the opinion that this is something that should not be supported. He said, how did one lead to the other? And he said, if you just know that I am miserly, you wouldn't be able to go from there to doing anything about it, because the miserliness manifested itself in a thought, and it embedded itself into your thought process, and now you have a different thing to deal with. It's not just a stirring of the soul, it's now a philosophy that you believe in, because there's, you know, a person has to defend their choices and their deeds. So there's a philosophy, it always grows. You almost always, you know, I'm running yeshivas for a bunch of years, so I have to collect money. So no one ever says, I'm not giving money because I'm a miser. They'll say, this is no good, that's no good. And there are 100 reasons they have. It's always reasons. It's never that I don't want to give you the money. It's always a reason. Reason, this reason, that reason, that reason. But those reasons are not reasons. Those reasons are the manifestation of what he calls the Rikshei HaNefesh HaPnimi, the stirring of the inner soul. And he says that what we have to do is understand how this leads to that. Okay. So now let me just start from the third line from the end of the paragraph again. He says, "Shamidos heim regoshim panimim b'nefesh." The character traits are inner feelings within the soul. Miskalim b'machshava, they become revealed in one's thought. Umishtarshim ba, and then they become rooted, like from the word shorish, they become rooted into a person's thinking. V'achar kach yotzim lepulos, and then they go out in the form of deeds. V'alkein hakora hanechona, the proper understanding, hirak bepnimios hamachshavos shabalev. It's only through understanding the inner thoughts of the heart, meaning it's not enough to know the inner flutterings of the heart, but you have to know the thoughts of the heart, meaning that it's the heart inspired thinking that you're dealing with. Again, because thinking purely rational thoughts is indeed a rational intellectual exercise, but thinking that is inspired by character traits, that's already something else. And he said we have to understand that if you want to make any meaningful change in your personality. That's something you've got to understand. All right? Please don't. Yeah.
So is he saying that there's a way to think rationally without character traits? Or is he saying that you need to be changing some character traits into other character traits?
He doesn't talk about, so the first thing he said, I don't think he talks about whether there is purely objective thinking. But I imagine that there is. He doesn't say that there isn't. There's, someone once said that the only thing in the news that's purely objective is the weather. That people don't have a bias that it should be rainy tomorrow or it shouldn't be rainy, you know. So, you're thinking about it rationally. Maybe if you're doing a math problem, it's rational. So probably you could have totally rational thoughts. But he says that when you talk about changing your personality, now you're talking about changing character traits. You talk about changing character traits, so he said, first of all, you can't change anything until you know what they are. That's step one. You don't know what you are. You read a Musar book all day, it's not going to help you. But he said, even if you do understand the character traits, you have to understand how they become translated into deeds. First they get translated into thoughts, and the thoughts get translated into deeds. And you have to understand the building of that process. So it's not, what was it, the way you put it?
There are good character traits and bad traits.
Good character traits and bad traits. There are. And good character traits have the same function. But the focus of his book is really how to uproot bad character traits. It's like I find myself acting in a way that I will later regret in such a situation. And then 5 years later, I find that I really haven't changed. And then 10 years later, I find I haven't really changed. And if you live long enough, it could be 60 years later, you'll find that you really haven't changed. He's talking about how to change it. How can you actually change it? That's really, really, a job. And it's really, really an enormous accomplishment if it can be done. And that's why this is a one-of-a-kind book. Because the other great books of Musar spoke more, not dispassionately, that's not the word, but more objectively or more theoretically in terms of rights and wrongs. And he's going to really discuss how I can make that get into me, this way or that. All right? Now, okay, so we're up to this next paragraph. Yinei ha-chovos ho-vavos, chovos ho-vavos, b'shar yichud ha-maiso, and b'shar yichud ha-maiso, that's one of the sections. The chovos ho-vavos was written a long, long time ago, I think in the 9th century. And it was, it was written by, I don't know if there were Sephardic Jews then, a Babylonian Jew, Rabbeinu Bechaya, Ibn Pekuda, or something like that. So he wrote this. He wrote in the Shar Yichud HaMaisa, Achrei Sheherich, he's here, the Shomer Meyetzer Hara, we will come to Im Ha'adam. After he elaborated and warned that one must be careful, guarded from the Yetzer Hara, from the evil inclination, b'muchamto ma'adam, and its war with man, b'etzos v'tachbuos, with ideas and tricks, v'shabesh esadeos, to cause the thinking and the thoughts to be mistaken, v'hachlish esamaisim, and to weaken the good deeds. And because this is the Yetzer Hara doing all this. Sayim Estavaro, the Chovos HaVavos concluded his words, Sha'ikar HaKol, the main thing of all, Hu HaPikuach Al HaMachshava Shebalev. He says that the main thing is the Pikuach, meaning the clever understanding and guardianship over the thoughts of the heart. Now again, that's that funny kind of usage that Rav Isaac Sher is talking about, the thoughts of the heart. The thoughts of the heart. And this is the language of Chovos HaVavos in the 6th chapter. The care and thought, Ushmirasa, and guarding it, it's proper for you. You shouldn't hold back. Lifkod machshavtcha, to guard your thoughts. Rayonecha, and your ideas, Vasharape Lipcho, he calls, translates it, the musings of your heart. You shouldn't, like, you shouldn't flag in your dedication to guarding these things. Kirova Hefsad Vatikun B'masim. This is interesting. The majority, this is the Chovos Levavos already writing, the majority of Hefsad, of loss, of deficit, Vatikun, and gain, B'masim, in a person's deeds, Lo Yia will not be, Ki Im Machmosam, will only be because of them, because of the thoughts of the heart. Kifi Tikunam, according to their Tikunam, according to their repair, Vefseidam, and their loss. Akan Lashano, this info here, are the words of the Chovos Levavos. So, it's amazing that the Chovos Levavos is saying, sort of like the main thing that will impact upon our being good people or bad people is the extent of our vigilance in guarding the integrity of the thoughts of our heart. All this is unusual because most people don't know that they have thoughts of the heart. They just make up their mind. It's a whole revelation. But these are the facts. The facts are that we have thoughts of the heart. I don't think we can read any more. If we're really going to stop exactly at 9 o'clock, so we have about 2 minutes. But I would like to give you an example that I myself came up with to illustrate aspects of thoughts of the heart. It helps explain the idea. And it's a good example because it's probably happened to most of us at one time or another. And when you stand back and look at it, you can say, oh, I see it. Thoughts of the heart. Most people have moments when they get angry. Hopefully it doesn't happen too often. And hopefully if you get angry, you don't become a madman, you don't start throwing, chairs through the windows. But you get angry once in a while, you're angry. So you have a situation when the person you get angry at is someone with whom you're very close. It's a parent, a child, a spouse. And even if you have a good relationship, but you get angry at your friend sometimes. You get angry at your... Now, using marriage as an example, I mean, I'm married, but not that I ever get angry. But it happens to other people. So if you... you're married, so... Let's say there are five irritants that one spouse does to the other. Five primary irritants. One, two, three, four, five. Five things that get me angry. There's 100 things I love about you. There's 5 things that annoy the heck out of me. Now those 5 things, when you're okay and you're on good terms, they're minor irritants. And, if you're normal and you're halfway decent person, these things, they bother you a little, but then, you overlook it and you keep going on good terms. But when you're very angry, those same things take on monstrous meanings. Like when I'm angry, the fact that you didn't, close the door and shut the lights, the fact that you didn't make your bed or you didn't pick up your socks, the fact that is proof positive of centuries of inconsideration. Not centuries, but for the moment, it shows unequivocally what a bad guy you are. Proof positive. And you see it. And if somebody wants to come and explain to you that it's not so, you're not interested. You're sure, you're angry. It means this, and it means this, and it means that. Now, 2 days later, everything is lovey-dovey. No problems whatsoever. Made up. It's like it never happened. The same thing happens. If you turn it over. I'm just trying to figure out how to open it. I'm almost finished, really. Okay, so I was saying, a few days later, when your anger is gone, the same exact thing doesn't take on all these lurid meanings. So what happened? You know what I'm talking about? Has anybody not had this experience? So what happened? Why, when you're angry, does this irritant prove that the other guy is a terrible person? Or at least terrible to me, and has always been that way, and this proves it unequivocally. Then, when it's not, I'm overdoing it a little bit, but to some extent, it takes on a meaning that it doesn't have when you're not angry. The same irritant. How do you understand that? So the way I understand it is because when your heart is overflowing with anger. So the anger of the heart, which is but an emotional stirring, begets thoughts which are machshavos shebelev. That those thoughts of the heart look like thoughts, but they are really prompted by and developed by certain emotional stuff that's going on within you. So that emotional stuff causes unique and distorted thinking based on what that emotion is. The thing that about anger that makes it a good example is that it's something that's not too personal. You say you get angry. Most people get angry once in a while. They're not too. It's not so hard to say. And it comes and it goes. A lot of other character traits are more more consistent, like if somebody is a little arrogant, they have a chip on their shoulder. So it's not like you get angry, you get angry once a month, or once in 2 months, or once a week, however often it happens, once an hour, whatever your anger quotient is. It happens, it comes and it goes. But if a person has a big chip on their shoulder, then that tends to go on all the time. So that person with a chip on their shoulder could have a whole thought process built up about all kinds of things based on this ongoing chip on the shoulder that create they gouge out the wholesomeness of the holiness of a personality in an ongoing way, and it's not visible to them. Just like when you're angry, even though you know that you're angry, at that moment you don't think that the thought process that you have, which is based on anger, is based on anger. It's the truth that you now see when you're angry. So that kind of thing, you don't see it. You just don't see it. So he says, so that's the kind of thing that this book is addressing itself to. Because we have these issues within us, and issues within us cause thoughts within us. And he said, in order to understand, or in order to proceed with any program of bettering of the personality, you have to understand how these thoughts become developed based on inner character traits. Okay? According to my book, according to my watch, it's 5 after.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, so that's it for now.
How are people feeling about your time in terms of starting? Are we tired? Are we bored?